Chapter 19. At the moment I did not know how to apply this remark. I thought at first of Fine and the dog. Then I adjusted it to the matter in hand, which was neither more nor less than an elopement. Yes, by Jove! It was something very much like an elopement, with certain unusual characteristics of its own which made it in a sense equivocal. With amused wonder I remembered that my sagacity was requisitioned in such a connection. How unexpected! But we never know what tests our gifts may be put to. Sagacity dictated caution first of all. I believe caution to be the first duty of sagacity. Fine sat down, as if preparing himself to witness a joust, I thought. Do you think so, Mrs. Fine? I said sagaciously. Of course you are in a position. I was continuing with caution, when she struck out vivaciously for immediate assent. Obviously. Clearly. You yourself must admit. But, Mrs. Fine, I remonstrated, you forget that I don't know your brother. This argument, which was not only sagacious but true, overwhelmingly true, unanswerably true, seemed to surprise her. I wondered why. I did not know enough of her brother for the remotest guess at what he might be like. I had never set eyes on the man. I didn't know him so completely that by contrast I seemed to have known Mr. Barrel, whom I had seen twice, altogether about 60 minutes, and with whom I had exchanged about 60 words from the cradle, so to speak. And perhaps, I thought, looking down at Mrs. Fine, I had remained standing, perhaps she thinks that this ought to be enough for a sagacious assent. She kept silent, and I, looking at her with polite expectation, went on addressing her mentally in a mood of familiar approval which would have astonished her had it been audible. You, my dear, at any rate, are a sincere woman. I call a woman sincere, Marlowe began again, after giving me a cigar and lighting one himself. I call a woman sincere when she volunteers a statement resembling remotely in form what she really would like to say, what she really thinks ought to be said, if it were not for the necessity to spare the stupid sensitiveness of men. The women's rougher, simpler, more upright judgment embraces the whole truth, which their tact, their mistrust of masculine idealism, ever prevents them from speaking in its entirety. And their tact is unerring. We could not stand women speaking the truth. We could not bear it. It would cause infinite misery, and bring about most awful disturbances in this rather mediocre, but still idealistic fool's paradise in which each of us lives his own little life, the unit in the great sum of existence. And they know it. They are merciful. This generalization does not apply exactly to Mrs. Fine's outburst of sincerity in a matter in which neither my affections nor my vanity were engaged. That's why, maybe, she ventured so far. For a woman, she chose to be as open as the day with me. There was not only the form, but almost the whole substance of her thought in what she said. She believed she could risk it. As he had reasoned somewhat in this way, there's a man, possessing a certain amount of sagacity. Marlowe paused with a whimsical look at me. The last few words he had spoken with the cigar in his teeth. He took it out now by an ample movement of his arm, and blew a thin cloud. You smile? It would have been more kind to spare my blushes. But as a matter of fact I need not blush. This is not vanity, it is analysis. We'll let sagacity stand. But we must also note what sagacity in this connection stands for. When you see this, you shall see also that there was nothing in it to alarm my modesty. I don't think Mrs. Fine credited me with the possession of wisdom tempered by common sense. And had I had the wisdom of the seven sages of antiquity, she would not have been moved to confidence or admiration. The secret scorn of women for the capacity to consider judiciously, and to express profoundly a meditated conclusion is unbounded. They have no use for these lofty exercises which they look upon as a sort of purely masculine game, meaning a respectable occupation devised to kill time in this man-arranged life which must be got through somehow. What women's acuteness really respects are the inept knees, and the sheep-like impulses by which our actions and opinions are determined in matters of real importance. For if women are not rational, they are indeed acute. Even Mrs. Fine was acute. The good woman was making up to her husband's chess player simply because he had scented in him that small portion of femininity, apostrophe that drop of superior essence, of which I am myself aware, which, I gratefully acknowledge, has saved me from one or two misadventures in my life, either ridiculous or lamentable, I am not very certain which. It matters very little. Anyhow, misadventures. Observe that I say femininity, apostrophe a privilege, not feminism, apostrophe an attitude. I am not a feminist. It was Fine who, on certain solemn grounds, had adopted that mental attitude. But it was enough to glance at him sitting on one side, to see that he was purely masculine to his fingertips, masculine solidly, densely, amusingly, hopelessly. I did glance at him. You don't get your sagacity recognized by a man's wife without feeling the propriety, and even the need, to glance at the man now and again. So I glanced at him. Very masculine. So much so that hopelessly was not the last word of it. He was helpless. He was bound and delivered by it. And if by the obscure promptings of my composite temperament I beheld him with malicious amusement, yet being in fact, by definition and especially from profound conviction, a man, I could not help sympathizing with him largely. Seeing him thus disarmed, so completely captive by the very nature of things, I was moved to speak to him kindly. Well, and what do you think of it? I don't know. How's one to tell? But I say, that the thing is done now, and there's an end of it, said the masculine creature as bluntly as his innate solemnity permitted. Mrs. Fine moved a little in her chair. I turned to her, and remarked gently, that this was a charge, a criticism, which was often made. Some people always ask, what could he see in her? Others wonder what she could have seen in him? Expressions of unsuitability. She said with all the emphasis of her quietly folded arms. I know perfectly well what Flora has seen in my brother. I bowed my head to the gust, but pursued my point. And then the marriage in most cases turns out no worse than the average, to say the least of it. Mrs. Fine was disappointed by the optimistic turn of my sagacity. She rested her eyes on my face, as though in doubt whether I had enough femininity in my composition to understand the case. I waited for her to speak. She seemed to be asking herself, is it after all worthwhile to talk to that man? You understand how provoking this was. I looked in my mind for something appallingly stupid to say, with the object of distressing and teasing Mrs. Fine. It is humiliating to confess a failure. One would think that a man of average intelligence could command stupidity at will. But it isn't so. I suppose it's a special gift, or else the difficulty consists in being relevant. Discovering that I could find no really telling stupidity, I turned to the next best thing, a platitude. I advanced, in a common-sense tone, that, surely, in the matter of marriage a man had only himself to please. Mrs. Fine received this without the flutter of an eyelid. Fine's masculine breast, as might have been expected, was pierced by that old, regulation shaft. He grunted most feelingly. I turned to him with false simplicity. Aren't you agree with me? The very thing I've been telling my wife. He exclaimed in his extra manly bass. He have been discussing, a discussion in the Fine meanage. How portentous. Perhaps the very first difference they had ever had. Mrs. Fine unflinching and ready for any responsibility, Fine solemn and shrinking the children in bed upstairs. And outside the dark fields, the shadowy contours of the land on the starry background of the universe, with the crude light of the open window like a beacon for the truant who would never come back now, a truant no longer, but a downright fugitive. Yet a fugitive carrying off spoils. It was the flight of a raider or a traitor. This affair of the purloined brother, as I had named it to myself, had a very puzzling physiognomy. The girl must have been desperate, I thought, hearing the grave voice of Fine well enough, but catching the sense of his words not at all, except the very last words, which were, "Of course, it's extremely distressing." I looked at him inquisitively. What was distressing him? The purloining of the son of the poet tyrant by the daughter of the financier convict? Or only, if I may say so, the wind of their flight disturbing the solemn placidity of the Fine's domestic atmosphere? My incertitude did not last long, for he added, "Mrs. Fine urges me to go to London at once." One could guess at, almost see, his profound distaste for the journey, his distress at a difference of feeling with his wife. With his serious view of the sublunary comedy, Fine suffered from not being able to agree solemnly with her sentiment as he was accustomed to do, in recognition of having had his way in one supreme instance, when he made her elope with him, the most momentous step imaginable in a young lady's life. He had been really trying to acknowledge it by taking the rightness of her feeling for granted on every other occasion. It had become a sort of habit at last, and it is never pleasant to break a habit. The man was deeply troubled. I said, "Really? To go to London?" He looked dumbly into my eyes. It was pathetic and funny. "And do you of course feel it would be useless?" I pursued. He evidently felt that, though he said nothing. He only went on blinking at me with a solemn and comical slowness. "Unless it be to carry there the family's blessing," I went on, indulging my chaffing humor steadily, in a rather sneaking fashion, for I dared not look at Mrs. Fine, to my right. No sound or movement came from that direction. "Who think very naturally that to match mere good, sound reasons, against the passionate conclusions of love is a waste of intellect bordering on the absurd." He looked surprised, as if I had discovered something very clever. He, dear man, had thought of nothing at all. He simply knew that he did not want to go to London on that mission. Mere masculine delicacy. In a moment he became enthusiastic. "Yes. Yes. Exactly. A man in love. You hear, my dear? Here you have an independent opinion. Can anything be more hopeless?" I insisted to the fascinated little Fine, "than to pit reason against love. I must confess, however, that in this case, when I think of that poor girl's sharp chin, I wonder if my levity was too much for Mrs. Fine." Still leaning back in her chair, she exclaimed, "Mr. Marlowe!" As if mysteriously affected by her indignation, the absurd Fine dog began to bark in the porch. It might have been that a trespassing bumblebee, however, that animal was capable of any eccentricity. Fine got up quickly and went out to him. I think he was glad to leave us alone to discuss that matter of his journey to London. A sort of anti-sentimental journey. He too, apparently, had confidence in my sagacity. It was touching, this confidence. It was at any rate more genuine than the confidence his wife pretended to have in her husband's chess player of 3 successive holidays. Confidence be hanged. Sagacity indeed. As he had simply marched in without a shadow of misgiving to make me back her up. But as he had delivered herself into my hands. Interrupting his narrative, Marlowe addressed me in his tone between grim jest and grim earnest. "Perhaps you didn't know that my character is upon the whole rather vindictive." "No, I didn't know," I said with a grin. "That's rather unusual for a sailor. They always seem to me the least vindictive body of men in the world." H'M. Simple souls, Marlowe muttered moodily. "And of opportunity. The world leaves them alone for the most part. For myself, it's towards women that I feel vindictive mostly, in my small way. I admit that it is small. But then the occasions in themselves are not great. Mainly I resent that pretense of winding us round their dear little fingers, as of right. Not that the result ever amounts to much generally. There are so very few momentous opportunities. It is the assumption that each of us is a combination of a kid and an imbecile, which I find provoking in a small way, in a very small way. You needn't stare as though I were breathing fire and smoke out of my nostrils. I am not a women-devouring monster. I am not even what is technically called brute. I hope there's enough of a kid and an imbecile in me to answer the requirements of some really good woman eventually someday. Someday. Why do you gasp? You don't suppose I should be afraid of getting married? That supposition would be offensive. I wouldn't dream of offending you, I said. Very well. But meantime, please remember that I was not married to Mrs. Fine. That lady's little finger was none of my legal property. I had not run off with it. It was Fine who had done that thing. Let him be wound round as much as his backbone could stand or even more, for all I cared. His rushing away from the discussion on the transparent pretense of quieting the dog confirmed my notion of there being a considerable strain on his elasticity. I confronted Mrs. Fine, resolved not to assist her in her eminently feminine occupation of thrusting a stick in the spokes of another woman's wheel. She tried to preserve her comite superiority. She was familiar and Olympian, fenced in by the tea table, that excellent symbol of domestic life in its lighter hour and its perfect security. In a few severely unadorned words she gave me to understand that as he had ventured to hope for some really helpful suggestion from me. To this almost chiding declaration, because my vindictiveness seldom goes further than a bit of teasing, I said that I was really doing my best. And being a physiognomist. Being what? She interrupted me. A physiognomist, I repeated, raising my voice a little. Physiognomist, Mrs. Fine. And on the principles of that science, a pointed little chin is a sufficient ground for interference. You want to interfere, do you not? Her eyes grew distinctly bigger. As he had never been bantered before in her life. The late subtle poet's method of making himself unpleasant was merely savage and abusive. Fine had been always solemnly subservient. What other men she knew I cannot tell, but I assume they must have been gentlemanly creatures. The girlfriend sat at her feet. How could she recognize my intention? She didn't know what to make of my tone. Are you serious in what you say? She asked slowly. And it was touching. It was as if a very young, confiding girl had spoken. I felt myself relenting. No. I am not, Mrs. Fine, I said. Didn't know I was expected to be serious as well as sagacious. No. That science is farcical, and therefore I am not serious. It's true that most sciences are. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.